Now tonight will be one of the biggest and most important one-day bike races of the year called Paris-Roubaix. I know you're all dying to watch it. Got your video recorder set, got your snacks ready, and you're ready? No, I'm sure it's just me. Where is it? Paris-Roubaix, between Paris and Compiègne in France. And what makes this race so interesting? It is one of the biggest and most brutal races of the year. Now, if you're not a cyclist, just bear with me. There is a point to this story, okay? Humour me, follow along. It's not only 260 kilometres long, but riders have to travel over 29 sectors of cobbled roads. And these cobbled roads are bone-jarring shockers. One cyclist described them like this. He said, the best I could do to describe it is to say that they ploughed a dirt road, they flew over it with a helicopter, and then dropped a bunch of rocks out of the helicopter. That's Paris-Roubaix. It's that bad, it's ridiculous, he said. Last year it was won by an Australian guy, a guy called Matt Heyman, in one of probably the best editions of the race ever. I remember watching it. We were on holidays down at Bawley Point, and I reckon I woke up half of Bawley Point as I screamed at the TV at 1:30 in the morning as he went across the line. A lot of my excitement was not just because he was an Aussie, but because of the context around the win, the circumstances in which it happened. You see, there he is, winning the race. You see, Matt Heyman was 38 years old when he won the race. He's been a professional cyclist for 16 years, so it's fair to say he was in the twilight, or is in the twilight, of his career. He's a big guy, and he's much more suited to riding over cobbled roads than climbing up steep mountains in the Tour de France. And so normally when he's riding in races, he's normally riding in support of other riders. But this race, this one race each year, Paris-Roubaix, is the one that he loves to ride and the one that he aims to win. But for 15 years, he'd ridden it and never got close. That was until last year when he was having a great ride. The favourites have been out in front, turning on the afterburners after each section of cobbled road, leaving more and more riders in their wake. And yet there was Matt Heyman, hanging on, riding well, until there's only five left of them at the front of the race. With about 17 kilometres left to go, they approached probably the hardest sector of cobbles, and with everyone rushing to be first onto the cobbles, another rider bumped him off the road, and he lost contact with the group. And to all who are watching, me and the commentators, and I'm sure everyone else, it seemed like this was a golden opportunity that had blown up in a puff of dust as the other four rode off. But then as the leaders get to the end of this, the cobble section 2 kilometres later, and they hit the bitumen, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, appeared Matty Heyman. He'd ridden himself back onto the wheels of the leaders and was back in the hunt. And on the road into Roubaix, the last few kilometres, the favourites were attacking one another. He hung tough, he closed down gaps, and he stuck with the big guns. And as they came into the velodrome, everyone was expecting the fan favourite, Belgium fanboy Tom Bonen, to win. Bonen had already won the race 4 times in his career. He was going for a record 5th win. And then out of nowhere, Heyman launched his sprint, held off the chasers, and was first across the line, to the shock and awe of everyone, including himself. Now, I was listening to an interview with Matt recently, and the commentator was saying that this was a massive lesson in perseverance. He'd persevered for 16 years throughout his career. 15 times he'd ridden that race. And on the day, he persevered. He never gave up. He could have given up. He could have bailed out. He could have done lots of things. But he just kept riding, and he came through. Friends, when life gets tough and you're following Jesus, how do you respond? How do you persevere? Do you stick with it? Or do you give up and bail out? That's really important for us to think about this, because in the passage we're looking at this morning, Jesus says, if you're going to follow me, then you're going to go through some pretty tough times. And friends, when you do, what's going to help you persevere? What's going to keep you going? What's the reason you have to keep on going despite the hardship that you will be enduring? Now, Matthew chapter 8 through to 10 that we've been looking at this term, Jesus has been making it clear that he's the king of God's kingdom. He's come with all power and authority. The kingdom of heaven is near because he is here. And therefore, it is a time for forgiveness of sins and calling sinners into his kingdom, because Jesus' mission is to come and seek and save the lost. And Jesus has been preparing his disciples, teaching them and in helping them to engage in his mission as he's about to depart. He's been teaching them that now is a time for urgent prayer and for urgent proclamation of the gospel. But he also wants to warn them. He wants to warn them that as they do that mission, as they go about doing what Jesus calls on them to do, they are going to face tough times of persecution. But Jesus not only wants to warn them, he also wants to show them how they can persevere through those tough times. What are the reasons that are going to help them sustain them through those challenging periods? So you see there on your outline that there's three things we're going to look at this morning under the heading of Jesus warns: the reality of persecution, the reason for persecution, and the relief from persecution. Well, let's have a look at our first point there, the reality of persecution. And verses 1 to 15 we looked at last week, Jesus has commissioned his disciples and he's sending them out on his mission. In verse 16 he says, and by the way, I'm sending you out as sheep among the wolves. And then Jesus goes on to spell out how and where they can expect this hostility to come from. And basically he says it comes from everywhere. So have a look at verse 17. We see it comes from the religious establishment. That phrase there in verse 17, local councils, refers to the Sanhedrins or the Jewish ruling council in particular. So these Jewish rulers and the synagogue rulers, leaders, were going to be a source of persecution for them as they went out on this mission. We see in verse 18 that it wouldn't just be the religious guys and the Jews, it would also come from the state authorities, from in particular the kings and governors, from secular rulers, Jesus says. And notice it will be from both Jewish and Gentile authorities. Both sides of the fence, both leaders sides on both sides will hate the disciples and the message they proclaim. In verse 21, Jesus says it won't just come from authorities and rulers, but it will also come from your own families. And in verse 22, he says basically you're going to cop it from everywhere. All men will hate you. And so Jesus is making it crystal clear here, friends, persecution will come from everywhere. The religious establishment, the state, the secular authorities, family, and all people. And so Jesus is not hiding the reality. He's warning the disciples of what to expect. He's saying this is what's going to happen. Don't be surprised by this. You need to understand that this is the reality for those who are serious about following me. Now, this persecution that Jesus is referring to started in the early days of the church, right from the start. And there were waves of persecution that came upon the Christians in those first few centuries. The most notorious was Emperor Nero. Nero, if you didn't know, under his watch, Christians were soaked in wax, tied to posts, and then set alight as lamps in his garden. In more recent decades, we've seen governments in places like China and Russia seek out and stamp out Christianity and arrest and execute its leaders. A few weeks ago, I got an email from Pastor Jagan. He was one of the pastors we met in and was a leader in the church in Sri Lanka that we met while we were over there on our mission trip with Island Gospel League. He wrote to me and asked for us to pray for him because he and his church are being persecuted by Buddhists there in Sri Lanka. John and Jan Bales, two of our Link missionaries in Greenacre, where they are ministering amongst Muslim people. And John will often say that one of the hardest things about sharing the good news of Jesus with Muslims and them putting their trust in him is that they know if they do that, that they will be severely persecuted by their families. And if it wasn't for the laws in Australia, they would be under the threat of death. In fact, refugees who are over here in Australia in places like Villawood who become Christians are fearful of being deported back to their home nation because they know if people find out that they've become a Christian, that they'll die. That's the reality that Jesus is talking about. Now, over the last couple of hundred years in Australia and much of the Western world, we have been free from a lot of that. And to that extent, the times we're living in or have been living in are abnormal for the church and for Christian believers. Because the normal pattern is for the world to stand against Jesus and his people. But I think you'll all agree that over the last couple of decades, the tide has been changing. Because hostility towards Jesus and Christianity is clearly growing. One of the areas Christians are facing the heat here in Australia is from hyper-aggressive atheists who are pushing an anti-Christian agenda right across the culture. We see this in various ways. One way is through an organisation called Fairness in Religion in Schools. They are not about fairness of religion at all. Their idea of fairness is removing religion, and particularly Christianity, out of schools altogether. And they're being very hostile in their approach to that, in the way that they are attacking Christians and people who teach scripture in schools. We see it with the LGBTI lobby, which is aggressively campaigning against anything Christian. This came out recently. I don't know if you saw this in social media. Cooper's Brewery recently teamed up with the Bible Society. This year's the 200th anniversary or birthday of the Bible Society. And they teamed up to have their light beer branded with the Bible Society logo and just celebrating with the Bible Society their 200th birthday. And on the carton of the Cooper's Light beer was the Bible verse, I am the light of the world, John chapter 6, whatever it is. Anyway, last month the Bible Society recorded and aired two Liberal MPs, Tim Wilson and Andrew Hastie, having a conversation around the same-sex marriage debate that's going on in our society at the moment, all while they were drinking a Cooper's Light. So there's the cans with reference to the Bible Society down the bottom there. Anyway, so these guys are having a friendly beer, having this discussion around this debate, this thing, all while drinking a Cooper's Light. And Tim Wilson supports gay marriage. Andrew Hastie is a conservative Christian who's in favour of traditional marriage. And it was respectful and genial, and it was meant to be light. The pun was intended, right? But the LGBTI community went ballistic. They hammered Cooper's Brewery on social media for their involvement in such discussion. They petitioned pubs to stop selling Cooper's beer, which many pubs threatened to do. And in the end, Cooper's was forced to issue an apology for their involvement and trying to distance themselves from any discussion that was not in line with LGBTI rhetoric. This is despite it being a friendly discussion with people from both sides of the debate talking in an amicable way. Similar things happening recently with members of that community pressuring IBM to sack one of its managing partners because he's a board member of a Christian organisation. And a similar social media campaign happened last year to the same man, forcing him off the board of Australian Christian Lobby and out of his senior executive position at PricewaterhouseCoopers. As a result, PwC lent on their exec to resign from Australian Christian Lobby. He later stepped down from his position at PwC, got another job at IBM, and a year later, they've come after him again and pressuring IBM to deal with him as well. Now, friends, this is likely to be the flavour of persecution and hostility you and I are going to face in the decade to come. That is, for you to voice a Christian worldview, let alone to talk about Jesus and the gospel, is likely to be met with hostility and persecution. If you're a Christian and you speak out on these issues, you're going to be branded a bigot and someone who hates the LGBTI community. You'll be portrayed as the evil one whose views need to be silenced, because for you to share with anyone else what you think, well, that's just plain wicked and wrong. The irony, of course, is the LGBTI activists who are doing this. They want equality and free speech, but they don't want it for Christians. They want to push their own agenda, but they want to shout down and bully and silence Christians when they speak. So whether that persecution is coming from your human resources department, or from the staff room, or from the school PNC, or from the education department, or from your friends, or from the media, the reality is that for those who are committed to following Jesus and carrying on his mission of preaching the gospel, this is what you will face. And Jesus wants his followers to know this reality. Because you can be sure if you proclaim the message of Jesus, people around you will hate you. And so Jesus tells us to expect persecution, but he also tells us, he tells us to expect persecution, but why? Why is it there is so much hostility towards Christianity and those who proclaim it? Well, Jesus tells us in verse 22. He says, all men will hate you. Why? Because of me. Jesus says, the reason you're going to be persecuted, the reason people are going to be hostile towards you is because of me. If you identify yourself with me, then it's me and my message that's going to bring the heat on you. Now, why is that? Why is Jesus so offensive to people? Well, one of the reasons is because of his claims. He's offensive because of the enormous nature of his claims. Jesus is always saying something, things like, before Abraham was, I am, taking the divine name, that he was there from the beginning. He says things like, I am the way, the truth and life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He says, when the Son of Man comes, he's referring to himself in his second coming, when the Son of Man comes, he'll sit on his throne and separate the sheep from the goats. In other words, on judgment day, people are going to come to him because he's the one who created the earth, he's the Lord of the earth, he's the judge of the earth. And people find that offensive. And when you have claims like that, well, what does that do? Well, it forces people to take extreme positions. You've either got to go full on for Jesus or full on against him. And the reason that it's offensive, because no one wants to buy into these claims that Jesus makes. No one likes what he says. Because when we hear these claims, it pushes us one way or the other. We can't sit on the fence. Because when you hear about Jesus and the good news of the gospel, either you have to say, I'm going to live completely for him. He is going to be the highest priority in my life. Every single decision I make, everything I do in my life should be done to please and honour him. Or you either do that, or you reject him completely because he's a liar and a fraud. In Flannery O'Connor's short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, the central character is a misfit. He's a criminal who's been killing people. At one point, he describes why he's so mean. He says, Jesus is the only one who was raised from the dead, and he shouldn't have done it. He's thrown everything off balance. If he did what he said, then it's nothing for you to do but to throw off everything away and to follow him. And if he didn't, then there's nothing for you to do but to enjoy the few minutes you've got left the best you can by killing someone or burning down his house or doing some other meanness to him. Now that's a more consistent message or response to the claims of Jesus than to come to church and say, yeah, I believe, but not centre your whole life in him, because that's just sitting on the fence, isn't it? Jesus is offensive, friends, and he forces us to extremes. If he did what he said he did, then it's nothing for you to throw off everything and follow him. But there's another reason why Jesus is so offensive. And it's not what Jesus said about himself, it's what Jesus says about how you can be saved. Jesus comes and says something way different to every other religious founder. You see, every other religious founder says, here's what you've got to do. Here's here's Buddhism's eightfold path. Here's the five pillars of Islam. Every other religious founder comes and says, here's what you have to do in order to be saved. Here's what you have to do to connect with God. Here's what you have to do, right? And Jesus says, you can't do anything. You're a sinner in need of saving, and you can't save yourself. You're broken and you're weak, and there's nothing you about you, and there's nothing you can do to merit your salvation. And I've got to do it all for you. I've got to do it all for you. You see, that's the most offensive of the religious claims, isn't it? All other religions credit you for doing stuff. Christianity gives you none of that. None. And people don't like to hear that they're sinful and no better than anyone else when it comes to standing before God. People don't like to hear that they can only be saved by God's grace. That they can only be saved because God chose to have mercy on them rather than because they somehow earned it or deserve it. So people find that offensive. So friends, if you identify with Jesus, then you're going to cop some heat. Because Jesus and his claims offend people. That's where it's going to come from. That's why it's going to happen. Now, if we left it there, you'd probably want to give up. Why would you want to follow Jesus if that's the life that lies before you? I mean, it's not a great campaign pitch, is it? Follow Jesus. Get persecuted. Sign up today. There wouldn't be a long queue, would there? But then in the next few verses, Jesus offers his disciples some relief. He offers them some comfort, some reasons to persevere, proclaiming the good news of Jesus everywhere they go, knowing that it's going to result in hostility. And in verses 26 to 31, Jesus gives three incentives for his disciples, which focus them on the future. And they centre around the three do not be afraid statements there in verse 26 and 28 and 31. And Jesus is saying, I know you're going to be afraid. I know this won't be easy. But let me give you something that will help strengthen you and help you overcome your fear and persevere in all this. And so the first one is there in verse 26. In verse 26, Jesus is saying, on that final day when I return, all will be revealed and everything will be made clear. And so as you go now proclaiming the gospel, there's nothing to fear because on that final day, it will all be laid bare and God's vindication will be yours. So people may laugh at you in the office now. They may mock you in your family. They may tarnish your reputation. And you may be unjustly accused. But in the end, everything will be made known by God and you will be vindicated by him. The second in verse 28 is God's power. He says, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. We may fear those who persecute us and harass us and are hostile towards us. But Jesus is saying, don't fear them. Because the worst they can do doesn't match the worst God can do. And so for the disciple who truly follows Jesus, there's no need to fear death because God is the one who oversees their soul. The worst that can happen to your eyes, we die. But God has your soul in his hand. His power to look after you eternally is matchless. The third reason is in verse 29 to 31. And it's God's care. And Jesus' point here is to say, if God's providence is so all-embracing that not even a sparrow falls to the ground apart from the will of God, then as his disciples don't need to be afraid. I mean, if God cares for this, the smallest, least significant thing in this world, like two sparrows and the hairs on your head, then how much more will he care for you? Therefore, you don't need to be afraid. Because God cares. But there's one final reason that Jesus gives that helps us overcome any fear of being disciples who face hostility for being a follower of Jesus. And it's there in verse 19 and 20. Jesus says, you'll never be alone. He says, when they arrest you, do not worry. Do not be afraid, Jesus says. Do not worry about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you'll be given what to say, for it will not be you speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. And what does that mean? Jesus saying, the Father will be there. If you get hauled up, if you get the heat, if you get persecuted, not only is that a good opportunity for you to witness to the Lord Jesus, but God will be there with you. The Father will be at your side. you'll never be alone. Now, how can you be sure about this? How can you be confident of God's vindication, God's power, God's care? How can you be sure that God will never leave you alone? Well, the answer is in verse 24 and 25. Because in those two verses, 24 and 25, Jesus is basically saying, when persecution comes, think of me. Think about how I've been demonized. Think about how I've been persecuted. Think about all the hostilities I faced. Think about how I was accused of being Beelzebub. And friends, think about the end of Jesus' life. What happened? We'll be remembering it this Easter. Everyone deserted him. They betrayed him. They denied him. They ran away from him. In his greatest moment of need, he was left alone. And it got even worse because when he was on the cross, what did he say? My God, why have you forsaken me? He was absolutely alone. No one was with him in that moment. The people he came to save, his friends, even the Father himself had left Jesus to suffer alone. Why? Because Jesus had come to take the punishment you and I deserve. You see, Jesus was experiencing the aloneness on the cross that we should have experienced so that we will never have to experience aloneness because we will be in relationship with the Father. Christ was giving his life for us so that we could be right with the Father and the Father could always be with us, especially in those moments of hostility and persecution. How would that happen? Because Jesus faced the hostility from the Father himself. And so friends, therefore you can know that you'll never, ever, 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 ever be forsaken by the Father. And friends, when you know that, you can get on with the mission that Jesus calls you to urgently proclaim the good news of Jesus that he's given us to proclaim, to go and pray urgently, to proclaim urgently, to invite others to hear the gospel, those who desperately need to hear it. For the King has come, and he's come to grant sinners forgiveness and welcome them into his eternal kingdom. They just need to hear it from people like you and me. Let's pray.